And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and today we welcome back as a special guest Dr. Will Davies. Will Davies spent 37 years working as an independent producer of mainly historical documentaries and series for the ABC and SBS. He had his first book published in 2004 and to date has had 10 books published, including The Last 100 Days and The Forgotten, with Will coming onto this program to discuss both of those. He most recently is the author of a new book called Secret and Special, The Untold Story of Zed Special Unit in the Second World War. Will was a member of the New South Wales Anzac Council, and COVID permitting, he leads battlefield tours to the Western Front in France and Belgium. In 2018, Will was awarded a PhD from ANU, and among other projects now, he's working to build a war memorial school in the French village of Pozières. Will, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Thanks, Bill, for having me.
So, Will, you've written Secret and Special about a virtually unknown chapter of Australian military history in World War II. You've tapped into the real-life adventures that the name Zed Special Unit conjures up. What first drew you into this history?
It's funny when you think often about where this idea came from or where this all began. In the case of this particular book, and I must make the point early that the Zed Special Unit was just a sort of a sub-department within a bigger department, a broader department called the Special Reconnaissance Department. So in the book, I'm referring to that, SRD, rather than the Zed Special. But it all began for me really in the early 60s. I was at boarding school. I was a little kid. I'd found the book by Ronald McKee, The Heroes, and it told the story of the Jaywick raid on Singapore with the crate, which many people know about. The crate now is sitting in the Sydney Maritime Museum. It sailed from Australia with four double canoe teams in it. Three were sent into Singapore. They put limpet mines on the Japanese ships. They paddled back to their rendezvous with the crate and came back to Australia very successfully. So this book, The Heroes, was the tale of Operation Jaywick to Singapore, but it was a time when the official files were closed. The story that Key was able to pull together was really from hearsay, from operatives, told an incomplete story for me. And as a graduate historian, not after I left school and then going into a life of history filmmaking, I always wondered what the real story or the complete story was. And the only way you can get to that is through official documents. Now, these were closed. They were highly secret. This organization was highly, highly secret. Men were committed to the Secrecy Act. And those files then were closed and hidden, put away in the National Archives of Australia. Nothing more happened for me until the late 80s when I was working on a four-part series for the ABC called When the War Came to Australia. And I decided to go back and try and work through these files, not knowing anything about the Zed Special Operations or the context. I knew about Crite. I knew about the sadness and the disaster of Rimau. So I went to try and retrieve the files. The first problem you have is trying to locate file numbers, series numbers, item numbers, things that allowed you to request a file. Now, fortunately for me, the War Memorial gave me a couple of numbers, and that got me to the North Archive of the National Archives of Australia. So I got about two or three of the six or seven that I requested. I didn't know why they weren't allowed. They weren't provided to me, it was hinted at me that they probably still contained intelligence information, perhaps radio frequencies, details that the government didn't really want researchers and people knowing about. So that being unsuccessful, I couldn't include this story in the series, so I then forgot about it. But as these things do, they sort of fester in your mind and you think, well, I wonder what really is in the National Archives. Now, by the time I relaunched into this in about 2018-19, the files, of course, were all well and truly released and open. Not only that, they're online on the National Archives of Australia site, so it was an easy task, rather than driving to Canberra all the time, to get files and to get access to the information I couldn't previously. So that then opened the way for me to write the book.
It's a long story getting to where we are now. And the designation Special Forces was not part of the British and Australian armies at the time. Why was that?
Even in the First World War, the British Army did not have designated special forces. They had units, perhaps battalions or even complete divisions that were A-class divisions, like all the five Australian divisions were in the top A-class. The Germans had developed, in the First World War, they developed special stormtrooper units that were specialist troops, but the British hadn't done that at all. Now, looking back, I thought about this, and when I started looking at history, there were specialists, military specialists, not in the same way as the Z Special or as the SAS might be today, but they were men tasked with doing special things. A great example is the sappers, and I love this story. It's, you know, you've got a castle, and how do you attack a castle? Well, one of the clever ways was the development of specialist tunnellers. And what they do, they tunnel under a castle, under the sort of corner wall of a castle. They'd start digging under the castle, and as they dug and cleared out a big area beneath the castle wall, they'd prop it up with wooden props so that it didn't cave in on them. And then when they were ready, they'd set fire, put a fire around all these wooden poles. The poles would burn, and the roof would collapse, and bring the castle wall down. And I thought that was very clever. Another thing they used to do is they'd put a circular trench right around the castle outside of whatever could be fired at them, whether they're early muskets, cannonballs, you know, catapult balls, arrows. And then once they dug that trench, then they'd dig a trench directly forward. Now, that was called sapping, and they were sapping forward, and that's where the word sapper comes from. Then they get to a point, this is a very dangerous point at this, as you sap forward in that trench, now you're facing the wall of the castle. They can fire down into that. So then you'd build another ring, and you'd gradually sap forward and build these series of concentric rings until you were very close to the castle, and you could then physically get men to attack it. Of course, then you had specialist units that... In Chinese armies, I mean, the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae against Xerxes' army at the famous Marathon battle, they were specialists. They were special troops. You had specialist troops that would capture ships and things. But the British Army didn't have it. And even in the beginning of the Second World War, they did not have particularly organized specialist units. They grew with the formation of commando units. They also grew with the form of in the desert, the long-range desert group, and the beginnings of the British SAS in North Africa. The Australians had none. They needed to find a way, as did the British, in fact, after the evacuation of Dunkirk, how they could attack, in the case of the British, the Germans in occupied Europe, and how we could attack the Japanese behind their lines and annoy them, because that was about all we could do in those early stages of the war. The British formed something called SOE, Special Operations Executive, and that was an organisation that parachuted operatives into France, Holland, the occupied countries, and they then formed and worked with the Marquis and the underground, the provided arms. They were the coordinating people for British supply of weapons, and they're also there to provide intelligence back to Britain. Now, this needed to be set up in Australia, and so in late 1942, MacArthur, Blamey, and the Prime Minister all agreed that this secret organisation, initially sort of known as Special Operations Australia, and a loosely associated with SOE, would be formed to put operatives, specially trained men, into Japanese-held territories to do a range of things: sabotage, information gathering, train local armies, coordinate medical supplies later in the war to try and extract POWs. And so that's how it sort of grew up.
Now, if we jump forward from the Persian Wars of 500 BC and we get to Pearl Harbor, the Japanese were advancing quickly.
Mm.
Can you set the scene for us for what it was like in Australia, say in 1941 after the Pearl Harbor attack?
Pearl Harbor, as we know, was a great surprise. The Japanese landed in northern Malaya, at Kota Baru. They quickly swept down through Malaya, took Singapore, and then they moved south into Borneo, Celebes, Moluccas, and then landed, of course, in New Guinea, took Rabaul. And they were knocking on our door quite early. I mean, the planes that bombed Darwin on the 19th of February 1942 were the same aircraft off the same carriers that bombed Pearl Harbor, you know, 8-10 weeks before. So there was great fear of invasion, as we all know. Now, there wasn't a lot Australia could do. England had well and truly tied up trying to defend the UK. Curtin realized there was no other option but to turn to the Americans, and as he said, I must look to America. And this was a crucial change in our relationship. We went from being really an English colony to an American satellite in that short period. And, you know, over the next few years, couple of years, over 1 million Americans flooded into Australia and then took the war. We came the base for the war as they moved back north again.
Well, we've set the scene for these special operations. We might take a break here. We always ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song for the program. And, Will, I think you've got one particularly appropriate for us.
But look, I've always liked Lili Marleen, that wonderful German propaganda song, as it turns out, sung by Marlene Dietrich, and the English version of that. So perhaps that might be an appropriate and period song that all these boys would have well known.
Outside the barracks, by the corner light, I'll always stand and wait for you at night. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through. For you, Lili Marleen. For you, Lili Marleen. Bugler, tonight, don't play the call to arms. I want another evening with her charms. Then we will say goodbye and part. I'll always keep you in my heart. With me, Lili Marleen. With me, Lili Marleen. Give me a rose to show how much you care. Tie to the stem a lock of golden hair. Surely tomorrow you'll feel blue, but then will come a love that's new. For you, Lili Marleen. For you, Lili Marleen. Marching in the mud and cold, and when my pack seems more than I can hold, my love for you renews my might. I'm warm again, my pack is light. It's you, Lili Marleen. It's you, Lili Marleen. My love for you renews my might. I'm warm again. My pack is like. It's you, Lily Marlin. It's you, Lily Marlin.
We're dads on the air.
And that was Lily Marlene, sung by Marlene Dietrich, as specially chosen for us today by our guest, Dr. Will Davies. Will is the author of a new book called Secret and Special, The Untold Story of Zed Special Unit in the Second World War. So, Will, we were just talking about the scene in Australia after the Pearl Harbor attack. As you mentioned, there was a call for something like a fourth unit. We had the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, but this was something new, wasn't it?
That's right. I mean, they realised that there was a need for something else other than the three traditional services. But what was it? Now, out of those fleeing Singapore, there are a number of men that belonged to SOE Far East. And they came to Australia and they were the core cadre of a very small group. We're only talking about 3, 4, 5 men that set themselves up in Melbourne with a broad brief of how do we hit back against the Japanese. They had the model of the UK, of SOE, but, even in Britain, there was great dissent about setting up an organisation to parachute men and women in civilian clothes back into Europe. They were slightly different. They weren't using Army and Navy and Air Force personnel in Britain so much. They were using Frenchmen and Dutch and nationals who could obviously blend in and speak the language and putting them back into their home countries. In Australia, it was a bit different. They had servicemen and women in the Zed Special organisation. But there were those that didn't like to see new competitive organisations be put up against them. The Foreign Office in the UK was very concerned about what they saw as a rogue group of saboteurs. The British Bomber Command weren't very keen to provide bombers and aircraft to deliver parachutists into Europe. They had better things to do, like bombing Berlin. MI5, MI6, these secret organisations didn't want a competitor. And it was a bit the same here. They not so much opposition, but in the UK, it was only that Churchill pushed it through and said, I want to. And as he said, I want to set Europe ablaze. But here, there was also military opposition to it because they weren't used to subversive secret units that didn't answer to anyone and had got lots of money and got it whatever they wanted. So it was a bit of a difficult birth.
The 1943 attack on the Japanese in Singapore Harbour, you mentioned a little bit earlier, it was codenamed JWIC. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, JWIC was this mad plan of, two guys. One, there was an Australian guy, Reynolds, who was in fact the one that saw the value of the Krite, which was actually a Japanese fishing boat tied up in Singapore Harbour, and sailed it to Ceylon, now Sri Lanka. He there met up with Ivan Lyon, and they sort of came up with this harebrained scheme of why don't we sail back into Singapore Harbour and do some damage. So the first thing they had to do was get the Krite back to Australia. It was returned as deck cargo. It was laid up in Sydney. They tried to repair the pretty ancient diesel engine in it. And it took probably a year, and it took actually Ivan Lyon, the subsequent leader, a long while to convince the military that this was a worthwhile attack. And it was only because he had contacts with the Australian Governor General and he had military high-end mates that he was able to get it through. Jumping ahead a bit, they set up a special training camp at Refuge Bay, which is a little bay, beautiful little bay on the Hawkesbury River in Sydney, a secret camp there, and they trained for about 6 or 8 months and did their kayak training and climbing and unarmed combat and explosives. And then the Krite left and sailed in this long voyage from Sydney up to Cairns, where it received a new motor, a diesel engine, then around to Exmouth Gulf. And there they picked up their kayaks and began set out on the long journey to Singapore. The Krite took these men, about 50 miles south of Singapore on an island, dropped their stores, all their boats and provisions for three weeks or something, and then it took off and went over to Borneo and just hid in the shallow waters over on the coast of Borneo. Meanwhile, the three kayak teams of two men paddled north. They spent a few days getting to a tiny island right off Singapore Harbour, where they were able to observe the ships coming and going and pick their targets. And then they made a first attempt to go in, but the tide pushed them back. And then the following day they tried again and got in. Limpet mined about nine ships, I think it was, and then paddled back, hid, and then over the next 3 or 4 days they made their way back to a rendezvous point where they were collected by the krait and returned back to Exmouth Gulf, or back to Australia, which was, you know, no casualties and a bit of damage and, a very audacious raid. Fortunately for them, they were very, very lucky and got back.
Well, some people have described JAWIC as the most successful clandestine operation ever, but then the follow-up raid, Operation Rimau, as you mentioned, was a terrible failure. What went wrong?
Well, sort of everything went wrong. It was a bit, you know, a bit ill-planned. It was overcooked. It was ambitious. It was. It involved a lot of men, a lot of, you know, Rimau men went by British submarine up with the idea of capturing a Chinese junk, which they did, loaded all their supplies on it, sailed it up right next to Singapore Harbour, I mean, within view of Singapore Harbour, but again, where luck was with the first group, luck was without, not with the second group. They were intercepted by a Chinese or a local native patrol boat. They fired on it, and, once they'd committed themselves in this way, they just had to escape, and they basically just took to their fold boats, their folding kayaks, and just tried to get away. And they were gradually picked off, caught in firefights, rounded up. Some of them died and drowned. Some of them were lost in actions. But in the end, those that weren't killed, 10 of them were finally put on trial right near the end of the war and then executed just in July 45.
I mean, just as an indication of how serious this all was, there were supplies of cyanide tablets, I understand, and
that's right.
Them.
No. They're all issued with cyanide pills, and there's only one occasion that I read of men ever using them, and they were two of the men on Rimau. One of them was Donald Davidson, who was at 2IC, and another Australian guy, and they'd been in a firefight. They had one grenade and a pistol left. The Japanese were landing below them, and they sat together, they leaned on each other's shoulders, and they took their cyanide pills and died. They did all carry them on the krait raid. They weren't issued to the men, but there was one point where a Japanese destroyer came very close. It stopped, it put a searchlight on them at night, it observed them for about 10 minutes, and I think they might have broken out the cyanide pills at that point to say, well, look, you know, we ain't going to get captured. We'd rather die than suffer under the Japanese.
Now, after the war ended, there was still a job for the special units because the Japanese, some of them probably didn't know the war had ended or didn't believe that it ended. So that probably went on for a while.
It was, yeah, it did. And it was the total reverse of, say, the surrender of Germany, where, you know, one, they were fighting in open country. They were all in communication. They heard the news. They were very glad the war was over, so they're quite happy to surrender. In the case of the Japanese, they spread over a huge area, often poor communications. They didn't believe it. They didn't want to surrender. Surrender was the last thing. So you had a whole series of factors forming this difficulty in getting the Japanese to lay down their arms. And so the Z Special Unit men, particularly in places like Borneo, were given the task of trying to find and negotiate with these rogue Japanese units, disarm them and bring them in. And some of this went on into, you know, the surrender was 15th of August 1945, and they were still trying to round up Japanese in October 45. And in fact, there were Japanese that didn't come in ever and surrendered in the 70s. So And I remember when I was working on When the War Came to Australia in the late 80s, there was talk of a Japanese that they'd discovered up in Rabaul or somewhere in New Britain, they thought. And there was a Japanese journalist, an older journalist in Sydney, who was issued with a Japanese military general's uniform of the Second World War to be ready if the time came that he had to be taken up to the jungle and with a megaphone or something declare that he's General so-and-so and order the man to come out. And so it went on for a long while.
It's an amazing look. Yeah. That's just one of the amazing stories in this new book, Secret and Special, by our guest today, Will Davies. It's got the real-life adventures. If people like adventures, this is not only full of stories, but adventure stories, but it's true. Will has done meticulous research on this to bring it to us. And Will, if people want to obtain a copy of Secret and Special, what should they do?
First of all, it's probably in your local bookshop. And can I say, rather than go to Amazon or Kindle or Audible or somewhere, go and support your local bookshop. These are small businesses that need your help and support, particularly Australian publisher, Australian writer. If you'd like a signed copy, I can very happily sign a copy. They're $35 plus $15 postage. And if you just email me on info@willdavies, one word, willdavies.net.au, we can make contact and we can sort out payment details and I can get you a signed copy dedicated to your dad or your son or whoever you'd like to dedicate it to. And they do make quite nice Christmas birthday presents when they're dedicated books.
And we'll have that on our website as well. And also, people that are interested in going on Will's battlefield tours to Belgium and France, you can contact Will on that same address. And I'm sure when they get going again, he'll be delighted to take you on a tour of a lifetime. So, look, unfortunately, we've run out of time today, but we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email. We'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show or any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now, Will, a special thank you and congratulations on your book, but thank you for once again being a guest on Dads on the Air.
Thanks, Bill, very much.
And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.